It's Monday, August 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, deadly bombs fall in Syria as diplomats struggle with peace efforts. U.S. presidential politics heats up with racial issues.
Investing in gender equality and women empowerment is not only a human rights issue, but it's a good economic and at the same time, a development imperative.
Gender discrimination in Africa proves costly. Heartbreak and country music just seem to go together. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Stephane de Mistura, the UN Special Envoy for Syria, has called for a 48-hour truce in Aleppo. He says the world body has in place an emergency response plan to provide humanitarian relief to the besieged city once a temporary ceasefire is in place.
We want a pause for 48 hours. The Russian Federation replied yes. We will wait for others to do the same. But we are ready. Trucks are ready, and they can leave any time we get that message.
In a statement, de Mistura said Russia has confirmed it will honor the proposed UN emergency response plan and is seeking the cooperation of the government of President Bashar al-Assad, Moscow's longstanding ally. The UN plan is aimed at providing emergency aid to tens of thousands of people trapped in Aleppo and to restore electricity to the city that was once home to 2.3 million residents. The plan comes as the British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says Syrian government helicopters dropped two explosive-packed barrel bombs on a funeral Saturday, just minutes apart in the Mahdi district of eastern Aleppo, killing at least 23 people. An unidentified member of the Syrian Civil Defense Force, known as White Helmets, describes the barrel bomb attack.
More than 20 people were killed. First barrel bomb dropped. People tried to escape to the shelter when another bomb hit the same location, and we have more than 20 people were killed.
The Syrian government routinely denies using barrel bombs, but analysts point out that Damascus and Moscow command the only forces operating helicopters over Aleppo. Meanwhile, monitoring groups in Syria are reporting at least 35 civilians have been killed by Turkish airstrikes. The deaths come as Turkish forces continue to move deeper into Syria in an operation against Islamic State and Syrian Kurdish forces. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkish airstrikes, supported by artillery, attacked Syrian villages Sunday close to Turkey's border that were under the control of US-allied Kurdish militia. Turkish military officials say 25 Kurdish militia members were killed and denied there were any civilian fatalities. In the same statement, the military said it's committed to protecting civilians under international law. Fighting has escalated since Turkey launched its Syrian operation Wednesday. Turkey has admitted the death of its first soldier in the Syrian operation. The Kurdish military put a video on the internet showing Kurdish fighters celebrating after destroying two Turkish tanks with a rocket. Ankara claims its military operation with Syrian rebel forces is against Islamic State militants and the US-allied Kurdish militia, the YPG. But since the capture of the border town of Jarabulus from IS, most of the Turkish operations appear aimed at the YPG. Ankara accuses the Kurdish militia of being a terrorist organization linked to the Kurdish Workers' Party, which has been fighting the Turkish state for autonomy for decades. But the YPG is backed by the United States as being one of the most effective groups fighting IS militants in Syria. The militia has inflicted a series of crushing defeats on the militant group and secured large swathes of territory along Turkey's border. Ankara fears the Kurds are seeking to create an independent state, which could incite Turkey's own restive minority, many of whom live close to the Syrian border. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, visiting the Turkish city of Gaziantep, close to the Syrian border, praised his armed forces for forcing IS militants from Jarabulus.
Teröristler daha düne kadar sınırlarımızın ötesinden Karkamış'ı taciz ediyorlardı.
They were attacking us from across the borders. Now they're running away, Erdogan said, and vowed to pursue these terrorists. Erdogan also said terrorist organizations use different names, but their tactics are the same. Earlier this month, Gaziantep was the scene of a deadly suicide bombing blamed by the president on Islamic State. Before his speech, Erdogan met with relatives of the 54 people killed in that attack. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
And of course, much more on what is happening in Syria online at our website, voanews.com. It's time for us now for a check of what's trending online with Michael Lippin. Michael, what do you have for us today in our social media segment?
Thanks, Jim. Well, one of the top trending items on Twitter worldwide right now is one of the biggest American pop culture awards shows. It's TV network MTV's annual Video Music Awards, or VMAs. Now, the show will be broadcast live from New York City's Madison Square Garden this evening at 9 p.m. local time, or 0100 UTC on Friday. The VMAs are on Twitter, at VMAs, and that's where you can find out how to watch a live stream of the show online. The VMA folks also have been tweeting a lot today in the run-up to the show as they try to build up the social media hype. They've been posting photos of some of the stars who will be appearing, stars like 21-year-old American singer-songwriter Halsey and the Barbados-born 28-year-old Rihanna.
Well, very exciting. And, of course, one big star who's actually making her first appearance at the VMAs in more than a decade, it's 34-year-old American pop queen Britney Spears. What can we expect from her?
Britney's coming back. She'll be performing a new single called Make Me. And Twitter is so excited about her comeback that they've actually created a little Britney icon or hash flag that displays every time someone tweets the hashtag Britney on VMAs. Not only that, but Twitter even created a yellow python sticker that you can add to your own image in honor of a 2001 Britney Spears VMA performance in which she actually wore a python on stage.
Oh my goodness. Well, from wearing a python to perhaps wearing not much, what's all this talk of going topless day here in the U.S.?
Well, you know, that's one of the top trends on Facebook today in America. And it's not as frivolous as it might seem. In several cities around the U.S. today, women's rights activists were planning to march while topless to highlight what they consider to be an unfair double standard in U.S. society, which considers it to be okay for men to be topless in public, but not okay for women to do the same. And I should add that the timing of Go Topless Day is no accident. Today's marches were timed to happen on the Sunday after Women's Equality Day here in the U.S. That's a day that commemorates the 1920 constitutional amendment that granted women the right to vote. But there are plenty of female Facebook users who are not fans of Go Topless Day. One of them, Tina Rimliotis, said this on news site SF Gates' Facebook page: "Sorry, ladies, but going topless does not give you equal rights. It just gives men exactly what they want to see. Hashtag sorry, not sorry." Jim?
Well, social media is exactly what we want to see and hear about each day. Michael Lippin, thank you so much for that analysis. And you can follow him on Twitter at @Michael_Lippin, myself as well at VOA Stevenson. And we also invite you to follow our international edition stream that's found at VOA_IE. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: help fighting terrorism on DACA agenda for U.S. Secretary of State. Raid on seminary in Pakistan detains 100 suspected Afghan militants. U.N. Security Council unanimously condemns North Korea missile launch. Afghan journalists fear for their lives amid terror and militant insurgency. African-Japanese trade deals expected from summit. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at our voanews.com website and also on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. If you didn't listen to the news for a few weeks and then suddenly caught up on current events, you might be struck by the divisive dialogue that's taking place in the U.S. political campaign. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman did just that, and he now returns to our studio with his impressions of what's being said out on the campaign trail.
Jim, I'm really struck by the extent to which race has become a central theme of this year's presidential contest. We have two white candidates vying to replace America's first president of color. And if you think back to 2008, Barack Obama didn't make a big deal about his race. It was somewhat self-evident when he came to the podium. John McCain didn't make a big issue of Barack Obama's race. And I think that there was this sort of sense that, wow, maybe the country in electing Barack Obama has sort of turned some sort of symbolic page and that better race relations would ensue. And you turn on the television today, Jim, and it's all about race. It's all about one candidate's comments about race and another candidate replying or condemning tweets about it. We have a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan running for Senate in Louisiana, a man by the name of David Duke. Race is really in our face right now in this political cycle, and I find it quite striking.
And maybe that's part of it. You mentioned that we have two white candidates in this race. Who do you think will best align with your values?
And we are a country now that is increasingly minority. In fact, they predict that minority voters will, in aggregate, become the majority of the population at some future date. Candidates need to have the support of minority voters if they expect to get into office. There is one big difference, I think, from this year when you compare it to 2008. We have been through months and months of very high-profile police shootings involving people of color, and just a certain sense of heightened sensitivity and friction when it comes to race issues. And I don't know to what extent that's dovetailing with our national politics. Certainly Hillary Clinton and the Democrats believe that they are the natural successor to Barack Obama in terms of appealing to minority voters. But what Donald Trump is making a very interesting argument. And his argument is, well, okay, maybe I haven't said things that you would think would appeal to minority voters, but look at the condition of Black America. Look at the poverty numbers. Look at the crime in our inner cities. You have been failed by Democrats all these many years. Why not try me? And that's sort of an interesting argument that we're hearing from Donald Trump nowadays.
What have you got to lose was his, his phrase.
And I should add that Hillary Clinton promptly put out a television ad using video of Donald Trump saying precisely that, what do you have to lose? And then a big, bold caption over it saying everything.
Right. We certainly are not the only country in the world with race issues. I can think of many countries and, you know, all different ethnicities involved. Most people, when they look at the United States, they see it as African Americans and white as being the real flashpoint. Donald Trump has also brought in Hispanics into this mix in a very bold way, saying he's going to build a wall. He's going to keep people, you know, from crossing the border to our south. And we even have now Asian Americans, very divided. They had been in previous elections leaning more toward the Republican side. Now you're seeing a shift because of some of the things that are being said. A very good textbook example of politicians trying to hit those emotional touch buttons.
We don't know exactly what determines how people vote, but obviously emotion plays a great deal into that. And it's some combination of the issues and emotion. And right now, America's emotions seem to be somewhat frayed on a great deal of subject matter. As someone who has to watch this, it will be interesting to see how this plays out, not just at the presidential level, but as someone who covers the Senate, this could really boomerang in terms of who controls Congress going into next year.
Well, our emotions are skewed toward very happy, welcoming back after a three-week deserved break, Michael Bowman, our VOA Senate correspondent. Thank you, Michael.
It's always good to be here.
By the way, Hillary Clinton received a national security briefing on Saturday, her first since becoming the U.S. Democratic presidential nominee. Major presidential nominees and their close advisors are legally required under U.S. law to be briefed with classified information on security matters by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence so that they'll be prepared when they assume office. Republican nominee Donald Trump received a similar security briefing earlier in the month. That reportedly lasted more than 2 hours. A new report finds economic and social discrimination against women is costing Africa more than $100 billion a year. The UN Development Program's 2016 Africa Human Development Report argues closing the gender gap would be a boon for the continent's economic and social prospects. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The report finds African women across the board are denied the same kind of economic, social, and political opportunities men enjoy. It says women lose out when it comes to education, work, and health. It notes fewer girls than boys go to school. Women earn less money than men for paid labor. Harmful traditional practices affect their health, and certain cultural norms act as a hindrance to women moving ahead in society. The report finds practices such as child marriage and sexual and physical violence adversely affect women's health and result in high maternal mortality. Ayodele Odusola is UN Development Program Chief Economist for the Regional Bureau for Africa. On a line from Nairobi, Kenya, he tells VOA evidence shows countries that invest heavily on gender equality tend to perform better on human development.
On the basis of this, investing in gender equality and women empowerment is not only a human rights issue, but it's a good economics and at the same time, a development imperative. What we learned is that if we are able to address the impediments in the labor market, for instance, it's going to enhance not only socioeconomic opportunities of women, but it's going to enhance the growth opportunity for African countries.
The report notes sub-Saharan Africa pays a very high price for maintaining discriminatory gender policies. It estimates total economic losses due to gender inequality in the labor market in 2014 cost the region $105 billion, or 6% of its gross domestic product. UN economists point to Rwanda as one of a few African countries that has increased the level of its Human Development Index. That is, its life expectancy, education, and per capita income by bridging the gender divide. Ayodele Odusola says some things are beginning to change for the better elsewhere in Africa. He says reproductive rights are becoming acceptable in Niger and Burkina Faso, countries where talk of family planning used to be taboo. He says Gambia is one of several countries that have banned early child marriage. The report proposes several strategies for creating greater gender equality. It calls on African countries to adopt legal reforms to give women a greater voice in decision-making, to actively promote gender equality and women's empowerment, and to ensure women have ownership of assets and management of resources. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The political party convention is a critical part of the American electoral process. VOA correspondents are there, reporting the latest developments.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Jim Malone, VOA News, at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Tune in to VOA's extensive, up-to-the-minute coverage of the U.S. presidential election.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. Romantic heartbreak is a common theme in country music. VOA Music's Nikki Strong and International Edition's Sarah Williams join us with some news about a reported setback for a country music star.
Last year, Reba McEntire split with her husband, Narvel Blackstock, and Miranda Lambert broke up with Blake Shelton. Now there's talk of another country music marriage coming to an end. Nikki Strong of VOA 1 is here to fill us in. So what's going on, Nikki?
Oh, my goodness. Heartbreak, disappointment, life. So several outlets, including E! News and People Magazine, are reporting that actress and country singer Jana Kramer and her husband, former professional football player, NFL tight end Michael Cousin, are separating.
Well, aren't they newlyweds?
Yeah, they are. They were just married in May of last year, and they just had their first child, a little girl, yeah, named Jolie, yeah.
Well, any word on why they're separating?
No, not yet, because this is almost like breaking news. But we do know that this news does come as Mike enters a rehab facility for undisclosed reasons, so no one knows why he's there and how that may play a role in what's happening. Neither one of them has released an official statement. The news also comes at a time when Jana is releasing new music as well. She's touring in support of her CD 31, and she has a new single out now called Circles. And interestingly enough, it's about an unbreakable bond. It's about loving nonstop. So hopefully this is a temporary arrangement between the two, and we just wish them the best.
Yeah, particularly with a baby.
Yes, especially when there's a baby involved who's not even one. So hopefully it'll all work out.
You can hear music from Jana Kramer and other country artists on VOA 1's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also connect with Nikki on Facebook at VOA 1 and on Twitter at VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks very much, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Just the thought of you around gets my head spinning.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website. That's voanews.com. You can also check us out on Facebook at VOA Now. Like us while you're there. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson. All of us are here in Washington, and we thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back again when you can, and have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Syria is one of the cradles of civilization, a place where humans first learned to live together in towns and cities. The societies that flourished in Syria mastered technologies including farming, pottery making, metalworking, and glassblowing, creating many beautiful artifacts. From the remains of immense Bronze and Iron Age settlements to extensive Greek and Roman cities, mighty fortresses and castles and masterpieces of art and architecture, these societies have produced some of the ancient world's most spectacular cultural treasures. Syria is home to 6 of UNESCO's World Heritage Sites, and another 12 have been nominated for inclusion. Today, these priceless antiquities are disappearing. Some have fallen victim to the country's 5-year civil war. But the greatest threat to these irreplaceable historic artifacts is ISIL, also known as Daesh. Over the past 2 years or so, while they controlled large parts of northern and eastern Syria, these terrorists have deliberately and ostentatiously destroyed some of the most significant archaeological treasures created by the ancients in Palmyra, Tel Adjaja in Mary, and dozens of other historical sites. But beyond their purposeful destruction, ISIL terrorists have also done a tremendous amount of pillaging, looting, and just plain theft. They plundered sites and territories they controlled, digging up millennia-old artifacts and selling them on the black market. The United States is committed to helping the Syrian people preserve their priceless heritage and to preventing these thieves of history from profiting from their theft and the destruction they have wrought. For that reason, the United States has, in early August, imposed strict import restrictions on archaeological and ethnological material of Syria, effective immediately. Pursuant to the Protect and Preserve International Cultural Property Act of 2016, these emergency import restrictions apply to any cultural property unlawfully removed from Syria on or after March 15, 2011. The United States will continue to closely monitor and raise awareness about threats to heritage in Syria and work toward preventing its removal or destruction. We owe this to the Syrian people, who are being stripped of their cultural identity, as well as to the world at large that respects, admires, and studies this heritage.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.